So what I'm going to talk about today is a project that I'm working on at the moment, a book project. For Manchester University Press, which is researching what I've called, just for sake of convenience at the moment, the post-punk process. And what I mean by this is the process whereby people know what I'm talking about, presumably when I talk about punk and post-punk. Yeah. So I just have to know when I teach, you know, when I teach the sociology of music, sometimes I find myself, I get very enthusiastic about things, and then I see this sea of blank faces and realise that I am granddad as far as they're concerned. So the process whereby punk took shape firstly in London, and then its diffusion from London to other key city-based sites, and the ones that I'm focusing upon are Manchester, Liverpool, and Sheffield in particular, and then its mutation within those sites into various different forms of post-punk. So in Liverpool in particular, there was a kind of neo-psychedelic scene based around bands like Echo and the Bunnymen, Teardrop Explodes, Wah, and so on. In Sheffield, there was very much a kind of electronic synthesizer-y type scene based around Cabaret Voltaire, Pop DVA, and most famously the Human League. And in Manchester, I suppose there were at least two big groupings. The Factory grouping based around Joy Division and Dirty Column and various other bands like that. And then The Fall, who, given their tremendous turnover of members, were probably big enough to be a faction in their own right. So I'm not going to be able to talk about all of that in this talk today. I'm just going to focus really on the beginnings of it in London, but I will also say a bit of something about Manchester. And what I want to try to do really is just explain some of the key ideas that I'm playing about with in relationship to this. It'll be inevitable that I'll start telling little stories about the history because I can't help it once I get going, but that's not really the plan. That's probably just what might happen in spite of the plan. I'm trying to conceptualise punk and post-punk in terms of Howard Becker's idea of art worlds, so thinking about them as musical worlds. And I think what I've taken from Becker, his definition of worlds, really is that a world is a form of collective action or interaction within networks. That worlds are very often centred upon particular spaces. So those might be performance spaces, they might be practice spaces, they might be distribution spaces and so on. And the idea being that those interactions and collective actions are generative of, and also then, having generated them, they follow distinctive sorts of conventions, which might concern all different kinds of things, from the organisation process through to the style manifest within the particular world. And also an idea that that all hangs on and presupposes both the distribution of and a mobilisation of particular kinds of resources. You know, you can't have a thriving art world unless you've got access to materials, unless you've got the money to pay for the equipment or the rehearsal space or whatever, so on. And again, I'm not going to be able to talk about all of those different dimensions in what I talk about today, and I will probably focus mainly upon networks, which...
Another button that switches this on. Struggling with it.
Okay. Yeah. So, just by way of definition, what do I mean by social networks? Well, I draw my definition of social networks from the specific dedicated social network analysis literature, wherein networks are defined firstly as a set of nodes, which you might define in any way that you want. Nodes might be cities, they might be chimpanzees, they might be human actors, they might be organisations, it could be whatever is of relevance to your particular project. But in my case, I mean social actors, and particularly social actors with an interest in particular kinds of music. And social networks also then involve a set or sets of ties between some of those nodes. And again, the ties can be defined in whatever way is relevant to your project. Often they're defined positively as some form of cooperation between actors, but they might equally be defined negatively. There are animal studies that look at which chimpanzees attack other chimpanzees in the troop or whatever. I mean, it doesn't really matter. It's again, from the point of view of the method, it's irrelevant how the tie is defined, but of course from the point of view of your project, it's absolutely central to make sure that you get you're looking at the right sort of relationships. And optionally as well, a network might involve a set or sets of attributes of those particular nodes or ties. So you might have different sorts of ties that are defined in different ways, and that's each one therefore has the attribute that defines it. And the actors can have different sorts of attributes. And smaller networks can be visualized. So this is the network of the of the Manchester scene as it was in about 1980. I'll explain some of the different sort of stylistic conventions later on as we go on. But the main thing to get is that there is these little shapes, whether circles or squares, represent a particular person, and they've all got their names by the side of them. And the line, a line connecting any of these two shapes, indicate that they have the type of relationship to one another that I am interested in. And in this case, the type of relationship that I'm interested in is some form of collaborative engagement in a common project. So if any two people have a line connecting them, that means that they have worked together in this in a musical context to produce some sort of musical outcome. So as a consequence, you get lots of clusters, which are bands, basically, because all the members of a band work together to produce songs and performances and so on. And if we define networks in this way, then those networks have mathematical properties. This method draws from a branch of mathematics called graph theory. But those mathematical properties can also sometimes be translated into sociological properties of various kinds, and also at various levels. So the network has properties at the level of the whole, the sort of global thing, and one example of that would be density, and density is a measure of how many ties there are in a network, expressed as a proportion of how many ties are possible within that particular network. So if you've got, for example, a network of 10 people, then there are potentially 90 ties within that network, or 45 ties, depending on how you define it. And if you've only got, 10 actual ties within the network, then the density of the network is 10 divided by 90. There are also properties at the level of the individual. In particular, network analysis focuses upon the centrality of actors to a network. And centrality can be defined in lots of different kinds of ways. But the most obvious and easiest one, I suppose, is degree, which is just a measure of how many ties each actor has. So if we were all a network, if I know three people in this room, then I've got a degree of three. Nikki might might know, 15 people in this room, she's got a degree of 15, and so on. And that's one of the ways in which we measure how central different people are to the network. We can also look at what's called the subgraph level. So we can look at particular groupings within the network, and we might define those in one of two ways. We might define them in terms of network properties themselves. So we might find little bits of the network which are much denser than other bits, to give one example. Or we might define it in terms of an external attribute. So we might say, okay, well, let's look at the men and the women in this network and let's see whether the men and the women occupy different positions, or whether they're more likely to be connected to one another than across than between the two groups or whatever. And finally, we can look at things like dyads and triads, but that's not too relevant for our purposes here. So just to give you some highly kind of artificial examples, a network might be highly degree centralized, meaning that there's one person or a small number of people to whom everybody else is pretty much connected, and that gives the network its cohesion. Or they might be highly decentralized, in the sense that everybody is more or less tied to somebody, but there's no cohesion or centering around a particular person. This would be an example of a network which is extremely sparse. There's only one tie between the whole set of actors, as opposed to this one, which is that same set of actors at a later point in time when there are an awful lot more connections between them. So this is much denser than that. And this just illustrates some of the other points. So I've used different colours. I think I've got black and grey. And the black... No, that's because it's been prepared for a journal which would only accept black and grey. I mean, I could have all sorts of different colours. So black and grey, and I think the black and the grey distinguish between what I've identified using network analytic techniques as a core within the network of people who are very densely tied to one another, and then a periphery of people who seem much less central in that, in the sense of not belonging to this core cohesive group. And then I think I've used circles and squares to distinguish between musicians and non-musicians. So these circles here, that's Rob Gretton, who was the manager of Joy Division. That's Martin Hannett, who was one of the big producers of Joy Division, Dorothy Collin, Buzzcocks and others. And that's TJ Davison, and he owned the rehearsal rooms that many of the Manchester bands all used. I don't know if people have ever seen the video to Joy Division's Love Will Tear Us Apart. And it's like a kind of a disused old warehouse space. Well, he owned that. And one of the things that interested me about this was that many of the big... Just another point before I get on to that. The size of the nodes is in proportionate to their degree, which I mentioned earlier. So the more connections they have, the bigger they are. And one of the interesting things for me was that many of the bigger nodes are circles, that they're non-musicians, that people who are doing other things than actually playing the music themselves. Okay, so I'll come back to that, but I want to turn now to one of the questions which is quite central for the project as I've conceived of it, which is how new musical worlds come into being, and in particular, of course, I'm interested in why did punk come into being, why did it emerge, when and where, and in the ways that it did. And there are lots of explanations, I think fairly commonly agreed upon in the literature that I ought to briefly mention. The first being the idea that punk was in some sense a reaction to the social and political economic crises of the mid-1970s, or perhaps to more enduring strains and grievances of working class youth in the post-war period. So the Birmingham CCCS line on subcultures is that subcultures of all kinds are forms of resistance to the domination experienced by working class youth, and that's true of punk as far as people like Dick Hebdige are concerned. And there are also other sorts of articles which tie the emergence of punk more specifically to escalating unemployment and social conflict during the mid-1970s. I think for a different project that I did, I looked at strike activity and days of work lost to strikes from about the 60s through to the 80s, and it pretty much peaks in about 1974. So it was a time of great conflict. But it's also been suggested in other works, and Dave Lang in his one called Wonders, amongst other people, suggests that punk was also, or alternatively, a response, a reaction to particular tensions within the music world itself. So it's very often argued that after the excitement of the 1950s, rock and roll in the 1950s, and the 60s, the Merseybeat, and those kinds of developments, when music seemed to be about ordinary people. It seemed to be that one of the attractions of the Beatles was that they were like the boys next door. They weren't these kind of distant, these distant figures, and so you got crazes of particularly young men going out and buying guitars and wanting to be in bands and seeing that as a realistic possibility, because there were lots of examples of it happening. All around them. But by the mid-1970s, the argument is popular music, or at least the sort of, there's mainstream music, and then there's the sort of alternatives and the underground to that, and that the alternatives and the underground had become dominated by prog rock, by bands like Yes and King Crimson and Pink Floyd. And the argument of people like Lang and others is that This music was, in a sense, it was distant. It involved big shows. It involved it didn't have the immediacy that the music of the 50s and the 60s had had. It was very complex. It was complicated. So there were concept albums like Pink Floyd's The Wall, which explored an idea over two albums. The bands would very often have banks of synthesizers. I mean, if you look at Rick Wakeman, and you can get over the fact that he's wearing a cape and various other sorts of things, you see he's got these banks of very expensive synthesizers and these kinds of things. And so the idea was, well, that just doesn't, no, nobody is going to, nobody can do that. Ordinary people can't go out and buy these various kinds of things. So the music seems unattainable. It's not something that you can do. It's something that you perhaps feel alienated from. And in some senses, the music of that era of the prog rock was trying to ape classical music, in the sense that the short 2 or 3 minute pop songs of the rock and roll era and the Merseybeat and so on had been replaced by these long virtuoso compositions that went on for 30 minutes or whatever, and to all intents and purposes were like classical compositions. And the argument is that punk was a response to, a reaction against that. When John Lydon, Johnny Rotten, was discovered on the King's Road by the other members and agitators within the Sex Pistols, he was famously wearing a T-shirt, a Pink Floyd T-shirt, where he'd written "I hate" over the top. So he had this big T-shirt, "I hate Pink Floyd," and there are lots of sort of examples to suggest that at least within the mix there was this strong antagonism towards what pop music, and particularly what that form of pop music that stood outside of the mainstream, what it represented and what it stood for. So punk has been analysed as a response or a reaction to that. But more recently, I think, there's been a recognition that actually there was a lot of resistance and reaction against that, against what pop music and rock music had become for at least sort of 7 or 8 years before punk came along, both in the States, in the form of a kind of resurgence of garage bands, and the two who very often referred to are the MC5 and the Stooges in Detroit, or alternatively in New York, a whole set of bands that had begun to cluster around a nightclub called CBGB's. This is where bands like the Ramones and Blondie, Television and so on were all beginning to take shape. A lot of the punks had been interested in the Velvet Underground, who were slightly before that, or the New York Dolls, who were again slightly before that. They were interested in a branch of music which, apologies for its name, but it's referred to as Krautrock, which is a German form of music, you probably have guessed, based around synthesizers, and I mean Kraftwerk were the most obvious the most obvious representatives of that in terms of well-known music, but it was a bigger, much bigger movement. And in the UK, in London, there was a growing movement of what's sometimes referred to as pub rock, which was bands like Dr. Feelgood. Sorry if you don't know any of these names at all, but it just helps me to say what they were, who they were, Kilburn and the High Roads, Rugulator, various others. And the pub rockers were very much like the punks, tried to strip music back to its basics. It was very raw rock, very raw rock music. And so some people have started to argue, the music journalists John Savage and also Simon Reynolds have both sort of started to argue that actually maybe punk was, if it was a reaction against what was going on in terms of prog rock, it was also a reaction that was drawing upon all these other diverse strands of responses to and attempts to break the stranglehold that prog rock had. So that's another often cited explanation. Another way of looking at this is in terms of opportunities within the mainstream musical world. There's some fascinating work by Richard Peterson about the emergence of rock and roll, and he says, well, why did rock and roll emerge in 1955? Why not 1945? Why not 1965? And he makes the case that innovation is constant and ongoing within music, but it only ever achieves anything, it only ever sort of makes a difference to the musical world when opportunities open up within the musical world for it to get a grip and take off and happen. And in particular, what he means by opportunities is when the domination that the major record labels exercise in relationship to music is broken, and there's an opportunity for smaller labels to break through. And smaller labels, he says, thrive on innovation because that's how they seek to make their niche within the market. So there's at least a possibility that seems to be a fairly reasonable account of rock and roll, and lots of people seem to agree that he's probably right about rock and roll in that sense, and that clearly could be true of other breakthroughs as well. And then there are things like the sort of media amplification and moral panic. I mean, are people familiar with the Bill Grundy interview? This is something I had to show my students because nobody had ever heard of it. I mean, and when I showed it to them, I was aware of how tame it was. But the Sex Pistols, who were the main punk band, appeared on a local London television network. They were interviewed by the anchor of this programme, a guy called Bill Grundy. I think Queen was supposed to be being interviewed, but the Sex Pistols got put in at the last minute because Queen pulled out. And anyway, the Sex Pistols were in the green room and they got a bit drunk before the performance. And Bill Grundy was a bit drunk before the performance, so it was a kind of bit of a fatal combination. And they turn up, and it's a two-minute interview. But in the course of the two-minute interview, Grundy starts to provoke the Sex Pistols. I think what happens is it's not just the Sex Pistols that are there, it's also a group of their followers called the Bromley Contingent, and Susie Sue of Susie and the Banshees was there. And Grundy starts slightly coming on to Susie Sue, which then provokes one of the Sex Pistols to call him a dirty something or other. And then he picks up on this and says, "What did you call me?" And says, "Come on, say some rude words. Say, you know, let's see how bad you guys are." So of course they do. And then the next day, that was the end of Bill Grundy's career. He never did anything after that. And the next day in the newspapers, the Daily Mirror had a headline. I think I've got it on one of the slides actually. "The Filth and the Fury," and the Daily Express had "Filthy Luca." And there was an outcry, there was a huge moral panic about the punks, and what are these punks, and where have they come from, and what are they doing, and you know, what sort of detrimental effects will they have on the nation. And the Sex Pistols, along with The Clash and various other bands, had been lined up to do what was called the Anarchy Tour immediately after that. Ended, I think, about 3 or 4 days after the Bill Grundy interview, the Anarchy Tour was supposed to begin, and there were about, I think there were 16 or 20 dates around the country, and all but about 4 or 5 local councils pulled out and said, you know, the Sex Pistols weren't to play. So there was this attempt to close punk down and stop anybody from and stop it from getting a hold. There was a very famous incident as well, in which was shown, there's a program about the 70s currently on the telly, and it was shown this week in, I can't pronounce it, Caerphilly or something in Wales, where the council hadn't banned the Sex Pistols from appearing, but when the Sex Pistols turned up, the whole local choir were there singing, and I mean, people know the lyrics to Anarchy in the UK, which was the first Sex Pistols single. It starts, "I am the Antichrist, I am an anarchist." And they, you know, they didn't want the anarchist, the Antichrist, in their village, and they were stood there trying to prevent the young people in the village from going into the hall to hear the Sex Pistols, which, as you can imagine, backfired sort of catastrophically. And any young kid in the 70s who was anything, had anything about them, I guess, thought that punk was wonderful. It must be wonderful, you know. And you mean nothing could piss adults off to such a great extent and not be wonderful and not be something that you really wanted to be a part of. So I think that's got to be part of the story of punk, that it did frustrate and horrify many public commentators at the time. They attempted to close it down and to stop it from developing, and in the way that we as sociologists would inevitably predict, that just generated interest. It made it bigger. The more you talked about the problem, the bigger the problem, became. So those are the sorts of explanations I think that we find standardly within the literature. But I think that they are, I think to some extent they're all true. I mean, to some extent, you know, I'm sure that there is something in all of those explanations. I think that the idea of strains, both social and aesthetic, and the idea that there were other things going on at the time that punk sort of drew together, they all go some way to explaining the motivation and the inspiration behind it. I think that must be true, but they don't really explain how punk happened, and they don't really explain where punk happened. So you know, you kind of think all of those things are true, but they're kind of generally true. They would have been true throughout the whole of the UK. So you'd sort of want to know, well, but why the big cities? Why Manchester? Why London? And it still doesn't really, for me, they're unsatisfactory in the sense, I mean, I do a lot of work on social movements, And one of the standard arguments in social movements is that grievances don't really explain anything. There's always things for people to feel aggrieved about. There are always social strains. There are always things that people are complaining about, but they don't give rise to collective action all the time. And so the question is, why on some occasions do they give rise to collective action and on other occasions they don't? And I think that kind of explanation, that kind of response can be levelled at attempts to explain punk in terms, simply in terms of strains or grievances. And similarly, the arguments about opportunities or about media amplification give us some idea about how punk became big and how it diffused. You can understand how it went from being something very small to being something very big, but you still want to know how it emerged and how it took shape as something small in the first instance. It presupposes the existence of something that we could call punk that was able to take advantage of opportunities, or that the various agencies of the media and so on could label and package and demonise as punk. And I think those latter explanations as well also explain entry to the mainstream, but they don't really say very much about underground movements. And clearly, punk for a while was an underground movement. It was something that was happening that not many people knew anything about outside of a very small, select crowd. And then post-punk, in many respects, was kind of deliberately underground and deliberately eschewed the mainstream, mainstream aesthetic values and the kind of popularity and everything that goes along with it. I read a great little article in the Guardian's guide thing about dubstep recently, and this guy said dubstep is dead. He said, by which I mean it occupies the top five places in the charts. There's 15 compilation albums come out about it recently. There's this. And the point being, actually, within certain contexts, popularity and mainstream success are seen as failures. That's the end of it. Once it becomes big, it fails to be anything of any interest or significance. And I think that was certainly true of many of the post-punk movements. They didn't want to be on top of the pops. They wanted to be something that stood for something different aesthetically and sometimes economically and politically as well, because there was a great emphasis on independent record labels and on fanzines and the whole do-it-yourself ethos really that had come out of punk, that said we don't want to rely on these big companies, we want to do it for ourselves. So I want to sort of restate the questions and say, well, okay, so how did punk come about prior to the infamy and moral panic? Why did it happen in the cities? Why in London first? And how did it spread and take hold elsewhere? How did its local manifestations begin to take shape? I'm just aware of time, actually. I've talked a lot and I've suddenly got that into a third of my slides tonight.
Well, you can have another 10 minutes.
I better zip through then. So this is the Phil from the Fury headline, actually. You can just see it behind the thing in the Daily Mirror. So my alternative, what I am suggesting in the arguments I'm trying to put together, is that punk came about when a critical mass of actors with an interest in non-mainstream pop music and the necessary resources began to cross paths, form bonds, and generate a network, which in turn then mobilised and coordinated the collective action that gave rise to punk. So it involved what we need to do, what we need to focus on, is the process whereby a network began to take shape. If I've only got 10 minutes, I'm going to skip very quickly over the stuff on critical mass. I had a few things to say about the idea of critical mass, but basically the idea is that you only get collective action when you've got a big enough group of people who are interested in whatever that collective action is about, who are prepared to combine their resources to bring that action about, whether their resources are effort or time or whatever else. And it also entails the idea that where that critical mass of actors might be a minority, they tend to have to come from a bigger, wider population in order for to be there in sufficient numbers. So the argument is a bit like the argument you might use when you're putting a survey together. You kind of say, okay, if we want to pick up significant numbers of a minority group in our survey, and we're just doing a random survey, it's got to be a massive survey because otherwise we won't pick up those minorities in significant numbers. And it's the same in critical mass. If there's only a small number of a small proportion of the population interested in something, it's got to be a massive population before you've got a big enough number of them to do anything. And there's a number of interesting studies which look at this kind of thing. Charles Tilly does an interesting analysis of the emergence of social movements and political contention in the 19th century, and he links this to urbanisation because, he says, it was only when you got these huge urban centres that you had enough people to begin to form political groups and movements and so on. Similarly, Judith Blough does an interesting thing on the provision of high art facilities in cities throughout the US. And she says, if you look at popular culture, you find a linear relationship between outlets and population. So if you look at cinemas, and the number of cinemas that you get in a city rises in proportion with the size of the population, she says, more or less in a linear fashion. But if you look at high art facilities, if you look at opera houses, or you look at a significantly sized art galleries, it doesn't go like that. You get the population can go up and go up and go up, and you get nothing. Then suddenly you get a jump. You, it's a certain population threshold, you start to find that you get high art outlets and facilities, and then they tend to come in significant numbers. You don't just get one, you get four or five or six all together. And she relates this to critical mass. She says, your city has got to be of a certain size before you'll have enough people in it to be consumers for these kinds of products. And I'm wanting to suggest something similar to punk. And there's also the interesting work of Claude Fisher, his subcultural theory of urban space, where he tries to tackle the idea that cities lack community. The kind of old Tunney's idea of community versus society versus these big impartial urban sprawls. And Fisher says, no, it's not that there aren't communities in cities, it's just that there are lots of communities in cities, and these communities become based around very specific shared identities or attributes. So very often they become based around ethnicity, but they might equally become based around interests of various kinds, and politics and music and various other kinds of things. And he uses a notion of critical mass as well. He says, for example, in a small town or in a small village, the members of an ethnic minority won't form a community because there isn't enough of them. If they're sort of 5% of the population, 5% of a million or several thousand isn't very big, it's not enough to create a community. But if you've got that same proportion in a massive city, that's a lot of people, and they will tend to gravitate together and form a community. So again, it's the same process. So I've kind of said that's why I think the cities are important. But also, what about networks? Why might networks be important? Well, there's a lot of work, and this is work that I've taken from the social movements literature, about the importance of networks to the mobilisation of social movements, and I want to say to the mobilisation of new art worlds as well. So So there are a number of arguments for this. One is that collective action necessarily involves coordination, which involves communication and therefore networks. You could have hundreds of people in a town, all with a shared interest, but if they're not in common, if they're not in contact with one another, if they can't coordinate their activities and say, right, let's take over this pub and have gigs every Thursday night or whatever it might be, then you're not going to get the collective action. There has to be communication and coordination, and therefore networks, if a critical mass is to be translated into a collective action. And similarly, if you need to be able to try to find people, one of the interesting things looking at the early punk scene is how musicians move about from band to band. So somebody might be a drummer with three or four different bands. And this, to me, indicates a process of search that's going on. Bands are saying, we need a drummer, and they're able to then find one. Drummers are able to say, I need a band, and then they find one. But they can only do that if there are these channels of communication provided by the network. But also, there's an argument that density and closure reinforce deviant cultural forms. There's been some interesting work on this done in sociolinguistics, where sociolinguists have identified particular pockets within national linguistic communities where people hang on to peculiar linguistic traits. So the argument is that most of us, our language is changing in a similar way. The national language is becoming more homogenous. Small regions are losing the distinctive aspects of their linguistic practice. But there are small pockets where that doesn't happen to the same extent. Small pockets where deviant linguistic forms prove to be more resistant and more stubborn to change. And those sociolinguistics have found that typically that happens in dense networks. That happens in areas where people have a higher concentration of connections to one another. And it's also argued by the same token that dense and closed networks help to facilitate the emergence of incentive of deviant incentive systems or situational definitions. So that's to say, people are only able to sustain an alternative reality. They're only able to sustain a distinctive view on the world and a distinctive set of social practices when they are cut off to some extent from the wider world, and when the proportion of people that they interact with who share those deviant incentives and situational definitions is large. And support is also an important part of this. I mean, if you read a lot of the stories about the early punks, they received a great deal of hostility from the people around them because of what they were doing. Punks were fairly regularly beaten up on the streets by Teds. The women who, because the punk look was very often based on the trappings of sexual fetishism, so the women would wear high dominatrix boots and very small leather skirts and basques and so on. They were attacked, and so the argument in that case is that, well, you have to have some sort of support system, some sort of protection system that to a degree insulates people from those external threats and reinforces a person's belief that what they're doing is worthwhile and is interesting and that they should continue with it. So do we find any evidence for this? Well, yes, we do. If we look at London in mid, this is all the people who were involved in the early punk world in London in 1976, and this is a snapshot from mid-1976, prior to the point when Carolyn Kuhn, who was a very influential music journalist at the time, prior to the point when she'd written the article that basically defined punk as punk and gave it a name, gave it a label. I won't I won't go into the properties of the network in any great detail, but hopefully you can see that it's quite a dense network. The average degree is 11, so most people in that network know 11 other people. And the vast majority of people in the network either have a direct tie to one another or they are friends of friends within the network. So if we were to predict that Punk must have had a dense and cohesive network in order to arise, then that prediction would be borne out. And interestingly, one of the things that's troubled me is why London first and not Manchester. I think this just comes from being a Mancunian and having a sense of local pride. Why did London get there first? And clearly there are lots of reasons for this, but one of them is the fact that in Manchester at the start there wasn't a network, and so there couldn't be collective action. It would be very difficult for Manchester to have have given rise to something like Punk, because the people who were interested in that kind of thing didn't have any contact with one another. They weren't interacting with one another. They weren't doing anything together, couldn't do anything together. But over time, they began to form network ties, they began to become involved with one another, they began to get to know one another and work together. And that was how Manchester was able to mount collective action and to do the things that it later became well known for. I'll stop there.
Okay, thanks very much.